Welcome, everyone. Thank you for braving the elements. I hope you're feeling a little drier and warm and cozy here. There's room in the front for anybody who wants to come a little closer. My name is Sylvia Westfall, and I am a science and healthcare journalist in Boston, and I'm really excited about the panel today. The title of the panel is Twitter Ate My Brain, and I'm sure you can relate to that feeling, and we all have felt that way about our devices. It's undeniable that our devices, the social media, our apps are here to stay, but as we all know, it's also undeniable that these devices, these technologies, and these platforms are having a profound effect in how we interact with each other, how we behave, and as our panelists today will explain, our brains may actually not be as well prepared to handle these technologies as we think. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists, but before I do that, and in the spirit of the topic of the day, I actually have a challenge for the audience. It is a very difficult challenge, so apologies in advance, but here it goes. For the next 60 minutes, try not to look at your phones. So, put them away, put them in your purse, hide them in your pockets, don't cheat and put them in between your legs so you can actually take a look at any text messages, and actually try to be present for the next 60 minutes because I guarantee that you're going to learn a lot. So I'm going to start by introducing our panelists. To my left is Sri Srinivasan, and he's the co-founder of DigiMentors. It's a digital consultancy firm that helps individuals and organizations be smarter and better at social media. Sri is the ultimate expert on social media. He was the chief digital officer of the city of New York, so that's a very small job, chief digital officer of the Met, chief digital officer of Columbia University. He also spent 20 years as a full-time professor at the Columbia School of Journalism. He was named one of Fast Company's 100 most creative people in business in 2015, the world's most influential chief digital officer by CDO in 2016, and one of Pointer's 35 most influential people in social media in 2010. He's a contributor to CNBC's Squawk Alley, and he recently also wrote in the New York Times a guide to social media, which I highly recommend for any of you who are looking to figure out how social media works. It was very helpful when I read it. So thanks, Sri, for being here. Next to Sri is Dr. Errol Miller. He is a Picower Professor of Neuroscience at MIT. He studies the neural basis of cognition. So his laboratory provides insights into how categories, concepts, and rules are learned, how thoughts become conscious, how attention is focused, and how the brain coordinates thought and action. Dr. Miller is the recipient of multiple very prestigious awards, including the election to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2017. And I have an announcement hot off the press, possibly still confidential because he found out this morning. But he just won the 2019 George A. Miller Award in Cognitive Neuroscience, which is a huge deal. Earl also has one of his research papers is the fifth most cited paper in all of neuroscience. And he's a co-founder of SplitSage, which is a company that uses his discoveries about the brain to improve safety and performance across a wide range of applications. Next to Earl, we have Dr. Marianne Wolf. She is an award-winning cognitive neuroscientist and child development expert. She has devoted her career to studying how humans read and think. She is the author of more than 150 scientific publications, but she also writes compellingly for the general audience. Her 2007 book, Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of Reading, won several awards, of the reading brain, I'm sorry, won several awards and has been translated into 13 languages. Dr. Wolf is also the author of Reading and the Brain. And most recently, and I believe it's available here, her new book is called Reader, Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World, and I highly recommend it. It'll change the way you read on your devices. It happened to me. And that book is structured as a series of letters to readers about how the switch to digital media is affecting the reading processes and cognitive processing. In a starred review, Publishers Weekly calls Reader Come Home a clarion call for parents, educators, and technology developers to work to retain the benefits of reading independent of digital media. So welcome, Marianne. Next to Marianne, we have Dr. Michael Rich, who is better known as the Mediatrician. It's true. He is the founder and the director of the Center on Media and Child Health, and is also he also runs the Clinic for Interactive Media and Internet Disorders, better known as CIMAID, both at Children's Hospital. Dr. Rich is an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's an associate professor of social and behavioral sciences at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And he has authored multiple peer-reviewed research papers, book chapters, pediatric practice policies, and he's testified to the U.S. Congress and other policymakers on his research findings. His research has been honored with awards from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine. Did I leave anything out?
Wait a second.
I just wanted to get a selfie with a selfie kid.
You
may recognize him, anybody who watched the Super Bowl last year. This is my patient, Ryan McKenna. And he's going to come, and he's here to tell us all what it's really like.
And Michael, let me remind you, you can use the microphone afterwards.
I'm used to
I think it's for the recording.
Nobody had a hard time hearing me, did you?
No.
All right, so let's get started. And Sri here is going to help us set the stage for our conversation by telling us, as the social media expert that he is and the digital media expert that he is, how has social media and digital media changed the world in very little time?
So I'm going to do something that's really unusual. I'm going to ask our panel producer for my phone because my notes are in my phone. So I'm going to just ask for that. Thank you. And I just want to say I'm honored to be here. I want to thank my classmate and the publisher of Boston Common Magazine, Lisa Pierpont, for having me here. I'm here from New York, and I love coming to Boston, and I'm here just for a few hours, but this is a fabulous program, and I'm just really delighted to be with all of you. So I tweeted all the answers to my questions that she was posing all here already, so I know she told you not to pull out your devices, but whenever you do, and if you go to at Sri on Twitter, you'll find a wide range of social media tips, as well as some of the stats that we've been kind of talking about and we will be talking about today. So hope you'll get a chance to look at them. But you know, when you see the makeup of this panel, you can sort of tell, as my wife could, as she looked at the list, she said, "You're going to be the bad guy on this panel because you're the social media person, and these are all the people who are going to tell you what everything I do is wrong." And so I want to make a couple of things clear first, that I love books and I love I love reading without books. At our house, we have 15-year-old twins, and we do what now is a very common thing called the device-free dinner, right, where you don't have technology at the dining table. And I read aloud the Sunday New York Times print edition on Facebook Live every Sunday morning, sort of like a crazy person. So if you're up at 8:30 tomorrow morning, every Sunday 8:30, wherever I'm in the world, we find and read the paper. So if you want to join us at 8:30, you can find us on Facebook Live, and we'll be reading that. So to come to the question of where we are with social and what's happening, I thought I would share with you some stats to give you a sense of what's happening right now in the social media world. And some of these might surprise you. You know, for example, we know that Facebook has, you know, top 2 billion users, but the actual number of people using social media on a regular basis is 3.1 billion people. There are altogether 5 billion people that have phones that may not be on the proper internet the way we know it. There are 11 people who start using social media every second, and 1 million people join social media platforms every day. So that gives you a sense of how broad this is. And we in America live and use Facebook and Twitter and those platforms, but there are other huge platforms in other countries, including places like China and names that and tools that you may not be familiar with, such as WeChat, Weibo, and WeContact in Russia. And most Americans aren't using a platform that almost everybody in the world uses except folks in China, and that's called WhatsApp. So let's see here, how many people are WhatsApp users in the room? So you can see. So these are the folks who travel internationally or have international families or some kind of reason to connect with outside the world. Most Americans aren't using WhatsApp, but that's an example of social media that we may not be thinking about. In terms of when we look at social, the range of ways in which we're using it is surprising to some folks, right? Like you've heard that YouTube is now the second most used search engine after Google, or that you're seeing the way that people are deciding, you know, from everything from how to vote to what to cook using social media. But at the same time, we've also seen in this past 2 years, I believe, the worst aspects of social media kind of highlighted, right? So I believe that no one's figured out how to use social media properly, not the founders of the companies that do them, and certainly not most of us. So we're in a situation where if the social media companies understood social media, there would be no Russian trolls on the internet, there would be no fake news, and there would be no President Donald J. Trump. He understood, and his team understood social media, and till today understand it better than most people who use it, and as a result are able to use the worst instincts and provoke the worst instincts of all of us to engineer the not just the political outcome that you saw, but kind of on a daily basis how we react to social media. I believe that there are so many good things about social that outweigh all the problems, but you can imagine that it's hard for people who aren't using it to understand why they should join what looks like a terrible cesspool of problems, right? So many of you, and we can do a quick survey, and this might help all of us. How many of you are on Facebook? Raise your hand. How many of you are on Twitter? Let's see, what else?
Instagram,
of course. Yeah, Instagram. And how many of you are on LinkedIn? Raise your hand. How many of you know what you're doing on LinkedIn? See, the hands start falling, or you turn into Indian dancers, right? This is called change the light bulb. You might know that move. I saw a couple of people with their hands up for LinkedIn. For example, LinkedIn is the most useful and underappreciated of all the networks. I believe most of us should be using LinkedIn instead of all these other tools, but we don't use LinkedIn. We may join it, but we don't use it because we think it's a job hunting platform, which it is, but it's a career management platform. I believe every 15-year-old should get a LinkedIn account and use it for the next 20 years.
Well, one of the things we were discussing when we were getting ready for the panel is that you view the current world of social media end users and digital media end users as divided into two kinds of people, and this might ultimately have an impact on how it works for us and how we fit them into our lives. You were talking about those of us who are digital immigrants mm-hmm. and those of us who are digital natives. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about
that. So she's referring to a TEDx talk I did on this topic, and you know that the all these corporations and everyone are kind of chasing digital natives and ignoring digital immigrants. And you understand the difference between the two. Digital natives are like the gentleman at the end of the line there, and digital immigrants are people who come to technology. I grew up with a typewriter, a manual typewriter, not even an electric typewriter, and kind of learned things along the way. And the point I made in my talk is that I'm a digital immigrant, but also an actual immigrant and to this country. And just like an immigrant like me might be more appreciative of this country than the people who were born here. And in some cases, I know more about this country because I actually look to understand it than some people born here. Same way with technology. You know, if you're born into the tech, you don't ever read a manual or look up anything because you know it all. And if you're a digital immigrant, you might actually look at a manual just the way an immigrant might look at a map, for example, right? So that's kind of the way I look at it. And so what I say to companies is that, of course, you want to get the people who are most tech savvy, but a lot of this technology can be taught. And what you can't teach is the experience. You can't teach context. You can't teach the ways in which you can use these tools for better and smarter ways of doing your work. So the last thing I'd say for now is to think about a term coined by one of my colleagues at Columbia. He was a former administrator of the Pulitzer Prizes, and he coined a term called tradigital, T-R-A digital, combination of traditional and digital. And what he'd say is, in journalism, but this applies to every field, that the most successful people are the ones who are going to have all the traditional skills, etiquette, ethics of their field, and have a digital overlay on top of that. And that's what's going to make you employable and useful and relevant as the world changes. And I believe whatever field you're in, to be tradigital, a tradigital teacher, a tradigital executive, whatever field you're doing is going to help you. Even if you're a musician or an artist, you're really good at your work, but you need those newer skills as an overlay to help your work be seen. We live in a time, and when I deal with authors all the time, I tell them this, there was a time when just the book spoke for itself. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case, right? You have to work to get the book seen and shared and read around the world, and you have to put in that extra work. I wish it weren't the case, but unfortunately it is.
Right, thank you. So let's, now that we have the background on social media and the impact it's having in society, let's talk about the brain so we can connect the two of them. So Earl, you're a neuroscientist. You study how our conscious mind works to make decisions, to complete tasks. And the work in your lab, part of what it does is tries to understand why the human brain is, as you describe it, simple-minded. And this has impact on how it interacts with devices. So tell us a little bit about what you mean by the human brain is simple-minded.
Sure. It's a curious fact of the brain. In fact, one of the fundamental things about the brain is you can store a lifetime of experience, knowledge, in your head in latent form, in long-term memory. But for some reason, our conscious mind can only process a very little bit of information at a time. I think it was single-minded, not simple-minded.
Oh, single-minded, sorry.
Our conscious mind is a very narrow bandwidth. We only really think about one thing at a time. For example, vision is a good example of this. Right now, you probably all have the impression that your mind is like a video camera with a wide-angle lens. You're seeing everything that's in front of you right now, all together, right? It's not actually what's going on. Your eye is darting around the visual scene 3 or 4 times a second, taking in little bits of the scene in little tiny sips, like you're sipping at the outside world through a straw because of this very limited bandwidth for conscious awareness. So you're sipping at the visual scene, but then your brain takes all these little bits and pieces from your eyes darting around the scene and puts together this illusion of wide-angled wide-angled vision. And we think this is because of brain waves. Why you have this limited capacity for conscious thought is because of brain waves. Now, you probably know what brain waves are. You probably heard of brain waves. When you put electrodes on your scalp and you record electrical activity, what you see is these squiggly lines. There are lots of fast squiggly lines when you're awake and you're alert. When you go to sleep, the squiggles slow down a little bit. And if there are no squiggles, then bad news, you're dead or in a coma. Don't want that. What we think is that what brainwaves are is your brain is like an FM radio. The brainwaves are carrier waves. They're carrying information. And there are different channels of waves for different sets of neurons, brain cells that want to talk to one another. So if two sets of neurons in your brain and brain cells in your brain want to talk to one another, they hum together at the same frequency in synchrony. They get on the same page. And different frequencies may be different channels for communication. And if neurons are humming out of sync of one another, like out of phase of one another, that prevents them from talking to one another. So these brain waves may be the fundamental way by which the brain regulates its own communication. But it comes with a fundamental limitation. If this theory is true, and we believe it is, all the information your conscious mind has available at a given moment has to fit into one wave. It's not the fundamental limitation. Now, you may remember I gave you the example of vision, how you're sipping at the outside world through a straw, and then your brain pieces this together into a delusion or illusion. We prefer illusion, no, not delusion. Illusion of wide bandwidth of your mind, which isn't actually true. It's the same thing with multitasking. When you think you're multitasking, you're not actually multitasking. What you're doing is task switching. You're switching rapidly back and forth between the two or three tasks or four tasks, whatever you're trying to do, your mind is rapidly switching between them. And this is you don't notice this because your brain papers it over just like it does in vision. And I can give you an example of how we can't multitask, but I need a volunteer. Marianne, would you like to be
a No. He would be much better.
No, you'll do fine. Everybody knows you can play along. If you have a piece of paper and a pen in front of you, play along. Here's what I want you to do. So what we did is I took a piece of paper, I divided it in half by horizontal line. Okay? And when I say go, and let me get my phone out, because I'm going to time Marianne here. When I say go, what I want you to do is write on the top of the page the sentence, no one can multitask well. Okay?
Okay.
And then when you finish that, go to the bottom of the page and just write out the numbers 1 through 21.
Okay.
Okay, so no one can multitask well, and then 1 through 21.
Right.
Ready?
Right.
Go.
1 to 21?
Yes. Great. 20 seconds. Okay, now turn the piece of paper over. Divide it in half again. Now I want you to do the same thing, only I want you to switch back and forth between numbers and letters. So N1, O, 2, etc.
I agree to do this only because I'm supposed to fail.
Everybody's supposed to fail.
I know.
That's the point.
I know.
Okay, ready?
Okay. Oh,
letters
God.
And numbers, switch back and forth.
Okay.
Go. Does the groaning help?
Yes, it does help. God, no one can multi. Why did I ever say these nice things about you? Okay.
Okay, that took about twice as long. Now, the first time that was easy squeeze, easy peasy, right?
Right.
What about this time?
Pitiful.
It was pitiful. You heard all the groaning
publicly,
and moaning, right?
Publicly pitiful.
If you could really multitask, you could do both those things equally well. But every time you have to switch between the numbers and the letters, your brain has to reconfigure. It has to redo its networks, and this comes at a cost. Now, another great example, I'll tell you guys about it. It won't work because when I tell you what the test is, but you can try it on your loved ones. If you really love them.
Yeah. Right. Before they ever.
So Google search, not now, of course, Google search Dan Simon's A Test of Selective Attention. And what we like to call this is the gorilla test. Because what it is, it's a video of two groups of students, one wearing white shirts, one wearing black shirts, and they're passing basketballs around. The white shirts are passing the basketball between them, and the black shirts are passing the basketball between them, and they're all moving around the screen. And you tell your loved one, or maybe your enemy, you could try that too, you say, I want you to count the number of times the white team passes the basketball. So they watch the video for a little while, and then you ask them how many times, and most people get it right, so I think it's like 13 or 14 passes. Then you ask them, do you notice anything else about that video? And most people, not everyone, most people will say, no, I just noticed the basketball being passed. Well, if you have them watch the video again without counting the basketball passes, what you'll see is a person in a gorilla suit walks across the screen, right in the center of the screen, the front of the screen, and most people don't notice that. It was right in front of them, but they don't notice because their attention was drawn to the passing of the basketball. So that's an example of how limited our capacity is for simultaneous thought. So we don't really multitask. We task switch because our minds are just constructed that way.
And obviously the reason this is relevant is that we all think we're getting really good at multitasking while we're on the phone, checking email, looking at our Facebook, and all these things that these digital devices are bringing to us. So does it increase productivity? I think most of us do. Those of us who do it, do we think we're getting better at it, or we're actually worse at what we're doing in that moment? I think in general, I thought I was being very efficient because I was reading something on my computer and then saw an email that popped. I answered my email. Oh, I got a lot done. Tell me a little bit about what science is saying about that behavior.
It's never more efficient to multitask. Many studies have shown that you're much more efficient when you monotask, focus on one task at a time. This is, again, if the brain is good at one thing, it's good at deluding itself. And this is an example of that self-delusion.
Yes, it's true.
But why is it then that we all seem to crave this? Because we all seem to love that all of a sudden we have all these things available to us that we feel so good about doing them all at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's because our brains evolved in a very different environment. Hundreds of thousands of years ago when the human brains were first developing and the primate brains were first evolving, we evolved in an information-poor environment. There wasn't much information available. And that information that is available might be very critical for our survival, like a rustling in the bushes could mean a tiger is about to leap out at us. So our brains also evolved the craving for new information. Our brains find new information rewarding because it was so critical for our survival. But at the same time, because we evolved in an information-poor environment, our brains could also evolve this single-mindedness. But now we're in this modern world where there's so much information available to us, our brains crave new information, they want some information, but we just can't deal with all the information that's available. It's like a perfect storm of bad behavior for our brains.
So then it is really true, as we all know, but now he's proven it to us. No driving and texting, and no, even talking on the phone and driving is probably not a good idea.
Yeah, if I have one message for everyone here, in addition to other messages, is don't ever use your cell phone when you drive. And it doesn't make a difference. I mean, it makes a difference not looking at your phone. You don't want to be looking at the phone when you're driving, of course, but even talking with a hands-free set or the speaker, it still greatly negatively impacts your driving. It's the cognitive demands of the conversation that uses up a little bit of that resource and leaves less cognitive bandwidth for you to pay attention to the road in front of you. Studies have shown that in driving simulators, that people using even hands-free sets, they miss as much as half the things in the road that's happening in front of them. And it's a curious thing about multitasking, by the way, is that we all, this is kind of self-delusion, we all think we're better at it. We all want to do it. But studies have shown that there's an example of a study from Stanford, from Melina Unkeffer's lab, who bring people into the laboratory and you ask them all, do you multitask? Some people say, no, I don't like to do that. I like to have a book and not a pad, and I like to do one thing at a time. Multitasking just feels stressful to me or inefficient. Other people say, oh, I do it all the time. I have my CNN open while I'm working, and I have the TV on, and I have my laptop, my cell phone available. I'm constantly checking my email, but I do it because it's more efficient and I'm really, really good at it. I'm better when I multitask. We test them in the laboratory, and the people who think they're the best at multitasking, they're actually the worst at it. And it's a self-delusional thing again. What it is that the people who multitask a lot, they have trouble maintaining focus on one thing. So they can't help but multitask. And then they convince themselves, they rationalize their behavior by convincing themselves that they're really, really good at it.
So Marianne, let's continue this conversation into digital media and how we approach it through reading.
So there are so many things I want to say to both of you. I wish I didn't have to talk myself, but I have to. So I'm going to actually use slides. Keith, if you put that on, because I'm going to talk fast through image and word, which is really a form of tradigital. And we'll come back to that word at my last slide. So Robert Darnton, whom all of you know from the history of reading here at Harvard, talks about a hinge moment. Well, we are in this new form of communication where we're moving not from oral language to written language, but from written a literacy culture to a digital culture. What I'm going to suggest to you is that I believe what we as a society need to do is to bring science and technology more in sync. And I'm going to use Sherry Turkle, my colleague at MIT, who talks about we transgress not because we try to build the new, but because we do not allow ourselves to consider what it disrupts or diminishes. So my work is truly to begin, not just my own work, but to bring a kind of analysis of all the things we know about the reading brain that exists this moment in time as a way of thinking, how can we both preserve what I will soon call deep reading processes in a landscape of distraction, and at the same time that we expand our cognitive capacities. That is truly my way of looking at tra-digital, and it's a word I'm just going to have to learn to use well. But it begins with saying, let's look at the reading circuit today. The first thing to say is that human brains were never born to read. We were born to see, to think, to use language, but not written language. Written language requires the brain to make its own new circuit. But the catch is, this circuit is plastic. It's going to reflect the characteristics of the writing system so that those who are speaking Japanese or Chinese are using somewhat different circuitry than those who are using English. Even English is going to be different from German or Italian for different reasons. So there's no ideal brain circuit. It has to be developed, and it will reflect not only the writing system, how it's taught, but also the medium itself. And here's where it gets interesting. The circuit can be simple, basic decoding, but all of you who come here are expert readers. You have learned to pull together that basic circuit with deep reading processes. The cerebral catch is that you can do it without doing that, without allocating time. And when I think about what you just said about the novelty bias or the novelty reflex, think about children who only have that basic circuit and aren't able to inhibit the bombardment of novel stimuli, which by our evolutionary reflex, we have to go to. Now, human beings can inhibit that more as we grow older, but children, this is an extra burden on them. Now, deep reading is something that I have been writing about in this new book and another book for Oxford Press, and I simply want to go very quickly about what you all do. And I use deep reading in the way literary theorists use close reading, but as a cognitive person, so I'm really trying to investigate what goes into this background knowledge. How do we, as analogy makers, take what we already know, put it together with this new information, and draw inferences, what I call the scientific method processes, inference, deduction, induction, etc. How do we pull all of that together with what is happening interactively, not linearly, the empathic, the perspective-taking processes that are really important to us? And here I want to just really suggest to you that these, oh, I should go back once, all of this we pull together to be critically analytic. Now think about this. It requires time to put all of those processes together. It just isn't a given. And when we are multitasking or when we are skimming, we aren't giving time to all those deep reading processes. So the question that I've been raising is the digital medium itself endangering unintentionally the allocation of time to those deep reading processes that ultimately end, and I use Proust's words here, what Proust said was at the heart of reading, what we do is we take the wisdom of the author to go beyond to find our own thoughts. This is the essence, this is the apex of the reading act that is the last thing we want to lose. Well, in addition to what Earl was saying, and it has so much to do with attention and memory, but I'm simply going to say, using my colleague, my new colleague at UCLA, Patricia Greenfield, that every medium, and now we're only talking about two, but every medium has what she calls the costs and weaknesses. Every medium develops some cognitive skills at the expense of others. Think Sherry Turkle. What does it disrupt? What does it diminish? The internet may and does develop impressive visual intelligence. The cost, seems to be deep processing, mindful knowledge acquisition. Are we so reliant on external platforms that we are not spending enough attention to remember to build our own background knowledge repositories? Inductive analysis, critical thinking, imagination, and reflection. And one of the things I can't talk to you enough about today, but I hope that at some point you might read about it, is one of the things I'm most concerned about is not just the end of critical analysis as we use it, but how that is the basis for the last part of the Reading Act, which is the deliberate use of our contemplative function. And when you think about time and all of these issues, you are worried, or I'm very worried, both about its formation in our young and our use in it. And Sri's wife is correct. I'm not setting you up, and you're not setting me up. We have to work together. And at Stanford this year, one of the things that we're doing is bringing scientists like Earl and myself and others with our technology and designers so that we can think, how can we look at what's happening? So the question becomes whether the affordances of the screen lead us to a different normal, one in which we are avoiding complexity. And this is where I do talk about Twitter in a very uncomfortable way. I talk about Twitter brains and trying not to be political, but it does, for me, it's the death knell of syntax, which is the reflection of the complexity of thought. Other than that, Twitter has many good things. But just to end a George Eliot-type sentence, the evidence is mounting that we are really becoming a nation, a people of skimmers, where we browse, we word spot. I mean, think of why we're here at the book festival, because we believe, like Italo Calvino, that the act of writing is to find the perfect mot juste, the perfect articulation of our thoughts. Well, when you skim and word spot, the art and the beauty of it can also be escaping you. By and large, most of us are doing an F or a Z when we read. We're spending about less and less time on focused reading, and we're distracted about 27 times an hour. So, I mean, I'm going to finish this with about 3 minutes of just blasting you with data. But the reality is that Barry Zuckerman and I, who's a pediatrician here in Boston, are working on the guidelines for the young, because I do believe that it's become the pacifier for the babies and the caretakers for a lot of kids. I don't want to be facetious at all. We really have to look, like Catherine Steiner Adair, at what's happening to the quality of attention in our young and how that impacts memory, how it impacts boredom. You know, one of the first things you hear from children when they go offline is what? I'm bored. There's a new form of boredom. Walter Benjamin used to talk about boredom as the hatch bird of creativity. I don't think that's the kind of boredom we have now. Now, I want to end with just a few of the most recent data pieces that I just came back with from Norway in what is called the Europeans e-read network. And basically what they're finding, and there's one, now we have studies from 2000 to 2017 that are being analyzed. We are seeing very interesting superiority of print over digital, over screen reading of the same text in the same students. Now, here is the interesting thing. They perceive themselves better on the screen. So their perception is that they are really doing, their performance is better. And this is another illusion in which they really aren't doing better, either across genre, across time conditions, and very interestingly, in this last study, which is not published, it's just going to come out. I have an advanced copy, but basically they took 171,000 participants in 58 studies, and what you see is this effect is becoming larger the more recent the studies. So in other words, the more digital screen usage by the native, our students, our youth, actually the worse the effect for digital screen, and they are oblivious to it. At the same time, the trends, and this is a new paper by Jean Twenge, is that we have, of course, the rise of digital media among about 82% of our youth, decline of TV, and what they call the near demise of print. And you and I and Jason, your son, where's Jason? Where is Jason? Is he here? Jason told me he reads almost 1,000 pages a week. This is extraordinary. The reality is that our children, our students, have now gone from about, it was 60% in the late 70s, read something every day, you know, a paper or a newspaper or open a book. It's down to 16%, even less now. So we have these trends and we have these worries. And I will end with the worries that I have. Will changes in the attention, the way Earl is discussing, and the immediacy, the ease, the over-reliance on external platforms threaten the very formation of an internalized knowledge? And if attention is so bombarded, if background knowledge is becoming less, will inference and critical analysis decline, leaving our young readers, and I would add ourselves, more susceptible to false information and less able to handle sophisticated tasks, whether it's literature, our contracts, our voting? And I believe ultimately that, I'm not sure I had this slide here, no I don't, I believe ultimately that the last thing I think I ever thought as a cognitive neuroscientist studying reading, I would be worried about democracy. But I've begun to think that, and I think we all would suggest this, the fate of a democracy depends on the critical, analytic, and empathic skills of our citizenry. And if we begin to be a nation of readers who are basically skimming and failing to use that, I believe we will become, like Jane Smiley said, I don't know if you have heard what she said about the novel. She said, the novel's not going to die, but it may become sidelined. And if it does, those leaders will lead us who have not read. And if they have not read, they will not understand other. And if they do not understand other, we will be ushering in an era of barbarism.
May I just point out that the person who reads the least is 70-plus years old, so I just want to make that clear. So it's not just the kids who are not reading. Our president doesn't read.
Sri, I was hoping that inference would be made without me saying it. And you said it, and I didn't have to. Thank you.
Well, not to continue with the negative sort of vibe.
Oh,
but,
I'm so sorry. I meant to say this was the slide for Sri. The whole point of all of this is that we must preserve as we expand. That's, I have the new word from you, digital.
I'm going to have to practice.
Sorry.
I want to leave time for questions, audience questions, but we also want to hear Michael and Ryan. Again, not to continue with the negative vibe, but I think we should discuss, you know, when social media, digital media gets problematic. And I think this is one of the things that you specialize on during your clinic. But I would also love for you to end up on a positive note, you know, what we can do to not let these things take over our lives. And this is also something you constantly try to work on with your patients. So why don't you tell us?
I'm a pediatrician, so as Judge Kavanaugh would say, my keg is always half full. You want optimism, you get it from me. I had said when we first talked about this that I considered the digital space, not just social media, but the digital space, as perhaps the most ubiquitous public health influence of this century. Ubiquitous because we're all exposed to it. We are, you know, none of us is protected by intelligence, by education, by affluence. But we need to learn to use these tools in very thoughtful, mindful ways. And I would actually agree with Sri that the good things outweigh the bad, but not yet. Mm-hmm. The good things are the potentials, but not the realities we've yet, because we have so embraced these tools, these very powerful tools, without much mindfulness, with, wow, look what it does. Look how many people it connects me to. And to speak about social media in particular, one of the mistakes that we make as individuals is that we use social media the way corporations use social media. We use social media to market ourselves to the world. We do not use social media in the way that it can be truly powerful and an instrument of peace, and that is by being authentic on it. And the way you are authentic on it is by showing your vulnerabilities. We lost a lot when friend became a verb. And when we really think about those friends and what friends mean to us, they're not the 967 people you've collected on Facebook, right? They're the people you can call up at 3 in the morning and say, I'm lonely. And I think that with this amazing connectivity we have just as we have skated over the surface with our so-called multitasking and really not delved deeply, with this incredible connectivity, we have undermined our deep, meaningful, protective connectedness with each other. The kind of connectedness that a true friend or family member or loved one has with you. So I think that, you know, the other thing that's not happening is not that people are not reading, and one in particular not reading, but we are not learning from history. George Santayana said, he who does not learn from history is doomed to repeat it. Read about the Weimar Republic. We're repeating it right now, right here. Absolutely. Sinclair Lewis wrote a book called It Can't Happen Here. Guess what? It's happening here. But if we go back a century, if I'm saying this century, the issue is the digital space. If we go back a century, the things that caused morbidity and mortality in kids were infectious diseases, birth defects, and cancers. Today, the three leading causes of death outside the birth period are injuries, homicides, and suicides. Dramatically different. But if we go back and look at what happened with that, remember, in 1918, not only did we not understand the human genome, we didn't even have antibiotics. Someone got sick, we gave them fluids, aspirin for the fever, we held their hands, and we prayed. But today, the leading causes of death are very different. We went back to 100 years ago and took an entirely different angle on it. We used environmental health measures. We discovered these kids were living in crowded housing. They were full of, you know, sanitation problems and toxic waste. And when we addressed the environmental health issues, those causes of morbidity and mortality dropped dramatically. Well, let's look at injury, homicide, and suicide. Let's also look at the long-term morbidities that start in childhood. Obesity, substance use, sexual and other forms of risk-taking that occur. When we have asked kids across the country in surveys where they learn about health, nutrition, relationships, they list the internet or entertainment media as their first and second choices, sources of information. Not school, not mom and dad, not the public health or their physician community. So we have to take a step back and really think about this not as vectors of good or as vectors of harm, but as the environment in which they're living. Look at how many people are using it and how much of their day they are using it. 90% of children use mobile devices before their first birthday. 90%. Adolescents, 95% are online daily, and 45% say they are on constantly. Their phone is in their pocket or under their pillow 24/7. And when you ask them why it's under their pillow, they say, it's my alarm clock, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you can't go to Walmart and spend $5 for an alarm clock. But I think that one of the things that, you know, has really been of interest in this discussion here, and I want to loop back to what Marianne said, is beyond this erosion of our connectedness, we have become so averse to, quote, being bored, that is one of the things that this actually disrupts and displaces. Mm-hmm. And again, learning from history, there was 100 years ago a very, very bored patent officer in Switzerland who used to walk to work beside the river and look at the eddies and swirls in the water and stamp a bunch of meaningless bureaucratic papers and go back home and write up a little thing called the theory of relativity. Mm-hmm. Late in his life, when Einstein was asked, how did you come up with this theory that people have spent a half a century trying to disprove? Mm-hmm. He says, it's because I was bored. Because my head could follow those eddies and swirls in the water and say, maybe time and space are curved. Mm-hmm. Maybe it works this way. And so I think that we need to bring back boredom. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Because it gives that vacuum. And that vacuum is not only creating available space for our imagination, for our creativity, for creating the new, but it also is a little uncomfortable.
Michael, so I wonder what the younger generation thinks of, let's bring back the boredom, Ryan. Okay.
Tell us, dude.
No. No.
No. Do you get bored?
Yeah, if I'm not on my phone a lot.
If you're not on your phone. Okay. When was the last thing you thought something new? That wasn't someone else's idea first. Okay. But you don't feel a need to do that?
No.
Okay. We should be passing this back and forth. He said no. So, from the other side, why? Why is your phone so important?
I use social media a lot, and it doesn't make it as boring. I don't play games. So.
Okay. Has it ever occurred to you that those games are designed to hook you in, keep you hooked in, and that someone is making money as a result?
No.
Okay. Oh, there's another mic for you. Oh, good. Okay. Here's an interesting thing that I've noticed with a lot of my patients, and I'm not calling Ryan out in any way, shape,
or form. Michael, and I think people might very quickly just want to hear Ryan's story.
Yeah.
What you're doing to work with him and other kids to turn this into something positive, and then we might have time for one or two quick questions.
Okay, I will move it along. Some of you may have recognized the shot that we opened this with.
Yes.
Twitter ate my brain. This is, in fact, the selfie kid.
Yay!
Right? Yeah, who Justin Timberlake sat beside and did a selfie with at the Super Bowl halftime show. And one of the things that Ryan and I have started talking about is how can we use Twitter not to eat his brain, but to expand his heart.
Aww.
To use the notoriety that he got through, really through serendipity, to make the world a little bit better because people are looking at him. People are following him on Twitter. And so let's hear what's happening.
With Twitter and stuff?
Yeah.
And what's your handle?
At SelfieKid, follow me. But yeah, so Instagram, that's where I usually post all my stuff. So I usually post, I obviously selfies with all these people. And sorry, what was your question? What was your question?
My question is, what are your thoughts, what are your ideas for making things better with this notoriety?
I don't know if I have an answer for that one.
Well, one of the things we've talked about, I remember, is one of Ryan's concerns when we first started talking about this was bullying in the schools and bullying in cyberspace, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And how can he leverage the attention, the profile he has to change that. These things are tough to do because as we started exploring it, there are a number of anti-bullying programs out there, and he's sort of thinking through which ones he agrees with the most, which ones he could synergize with the most, et cetera. So this is sort of one of the ideas that has been used, which is how can we leverage the 15 minutes of fame that Andy Warhol gave us into making the world a little bit better. And this is what I'm talking about the good being more potential than real yet, and that we have to be active about seeking the better. And one of the things I often talk about is instead of developing killer apps, we should be developing killer bees. Those are be balanced, be mindful, and above all, be present.
Well, this is a perfect time to open it up to one or two audience questions. And I think we have a microphone, possibly, or maybe we'll...
So during the introduction, if I heard correctly, they were talking about how you treat internet disorders. Can you explain what that is?
Oh, yeah, very good. For about two decades, there has been huge controversies and arguments in the psychiatry world and then in the larger medical world about whether one could be addicted to first video games and now internet, social media, et cetera. And there's been a lot of heat, but not very much light in this. The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses, in its most recent version says there's something called internet gaming disorder that requires further research. It is not a diagnosis yet. The WHO has just determined gaming disorder as a diagnosis internationally. For 20 or so years, China and Korea have been struggling with this mightily. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we grew out of the Center on Media and Child Health at Boston Children's is the Clinic for Interactive Media and Internet Disorders, or CIMAID, because a number of kids, and Ryan is not one of them, I'll just say, a number of kids and their families have come to us and said, my kids dropped out of school. I've had kids who have attempted suicide because their parents took the routers out. I mean, it's a serious problem for some kids. But I have problems with a couple of things. Number one, use of the word addiction, because it's not accurate. It is not the same as heroin, tobacco, cocaine, alcohol. It's not physiologically the same, but as a pediatrician, one of the things that really bothers me about it is it's so stigmatizing that parents won't see their child as needing help early enough to really help them in meaningful mm-hmm. ways, because they think of a junkie in a shooting gallery as an addict, but not their 10-year-old who has a hissy fit because he's got to stop playing Fortnite and go to bed. We're also seeing that it's way more than gaming. We're seeing four manifestations. We're seeing gaming, predominantly in boys, social media, predominantly in girls. We are seeing pornography use, which they usually don't fess up to until much later on in the relationship, and what we're calling information binging, watching these endless videos, short-form videos on YouTube or Twitch, et cetera. I mean, there's even a subculture of not playing video games, but watching other people play video games online. So there's a whole thing going on. And, you know, it's very easy to sort of discount it as these are just pain in the butt kids or, you know, going through a phase or whatever. But many of these applications are designed around variable reward so that you are drawn in not just by the possibility of success, but more importantly, your near misses, and you get closer and closer. And the same thing happens with social media with likes. So what we have created, and it really is the first in a sort of an academic medical center, is an evidence-based clinic where we diagnose and treat these four manifestations of what we think is now not a standalone diagnosis that needs a name, but actually presentations of known conditions like ADHD, like anxiety disorders, mood disorders, et cetera, that are just expressing themselves in this new environment.
Right. I think we might have time for maybe one quick question before the last question, and we say thank you to the panelists. A quick raise of hands. Who survived the challenge of not using their phones? That's pretty good. All right.
Now you,
our heroes.
Okay, one more question, please.
Yeah. So I have one question. It was about the LinkedIn comment you had made earlier, Sri, I believe. So I actually encountered an interesting situation where I was updating my father's LinkedIn, and he has the data to put into LinkedIn what it needs for people to find him, to connect with him, but I have the knowledge and background, because I'm a digital native, to actually update that. So when I was asking him about, you know, what papers did you publish while you were in grad school? What did you do this? He didn't understand the reasons why putting that in there would be interesting. But for me, I'm desperately grabbing for anything I can to distinguish myself. So I'm interested to what do you think about that. Also, I will note that Sri liked my tweets during this. So
oh, no.
He was also on his phone.
Oh, no.
Sylvia.
Sylvia,
this
you
woman
test
has
you?
A question. This yeah. woman has a question.
Sorry.
No, I
please.
Sri, you want to quickly?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm wondering, in terms of augmented reality and immersive, how is that changing people's brain? What's the impact of being in those immersive, real environments on people's sense of context, time?
All right, so that's you.
The real answer is we don't know yet, right?
That is the real answer.
We're this is again an example of saying, wow, look how cool this is. Let's just do it, right? And this is one of the reasons why we are currently conducting a longitudinal study akin to the Framingham Heart Study across the province of Alberta, Canada, with 3,000 kids, doing a deep dive on their not just their media use, but their media exposure, their ambient exposure, what's going on over here and over there. For 1 week each year, year after year after year, to see if we're actually changing the way we process information. Mm. We're also collecting a lot of physical, mental, and social health data at the same time. And even more cool, we're doing epigenetics. We're doing buccal swabs on them to see if even within a generation there's epigenetic changes.
So I have a suggestion, Sri. Maybe you can connect with her offline. And I actually think, unfortunately, we've run out of time. So please thank our panelists. Thank you so much for being here.
Guys, can we get a photo?
Oh, yeah, sure.